Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who were these guys?
I have a question for you.
Who doesn't want a party?
Well, because as I understand it, you're on Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast so good it just has to be fattening, brought to you by filmscorerejects.com.
.com?
.com.
Dot brains. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's definitely someone who would call for more cops, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
Send more paramedics.
Man, these are like the most crafty zombies I have ever seen.
Well, you know, we're going to get into this, but
yes,
yeah, this film was a complete reinvention of the tropes, and there's a whole lot to dig into here. We're going to take a big old bite out of this one, if you will.
We're going to dig 6 feet under,
if you will.
Really get to it. Even if you won't.
We are going to resurrect the puns.
Hey-o.
This is going to be a really interesting time because this month we are kicking something off. We are kicking on how have we not covered that? It's literally just a bunch of films where we pulled out 6 films out of our ass and then whittled it down to 4 and said, how have we not covered that?
Alternately titled Whatever the Fuck We Want Vember. So
yeah,
there's not
but
really
it's not,
a theme.
But it's not fair to call it that because like we would invariably go for something more obscure and be like, oh, well, there's this cool thing. And we're like, no, how have we not talked about that? And right at the top of the list of things we've not talked about, how have we not talked about Return of the Living Dead?
In the dark of the night, something strange is going on.
Do you want a
pie? You see that movie, Night of the Living Dead?
The dead have risen from the grave.
Mister, there's 100 of those things out there.
How many did you say?
100.
And now the question is, how do we get them back into the ground?
It's all over everything!
Stupid asshole!
Watch your tongue, boy, if you like this job!
Like this job!
I'm brain!
I'm brain!
Medical science is battled.
And it's a puzzle. Because technically, you're not alive.
The police are confused.
Send more cops.
It worked in the movie!
Well, it ain't working now.
Bring the movie line!
It's not a bad question, Bert. It's not a bad question, Bert. It's not a bad question, Bert.
The Return of the Living Dead.
If you want to go back and see all the times we failed to talk about Return of the Living Dead, you can go to iTunes and you can also go to Spotify. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this during a regular episode yet, but Junk Food Cinema is on Spotify. So if you're there anyway to listen to your Bruno Mars and your Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and whatever the kids are listening to these days, you can also just...
Bruno Mars, that's like Bruce Willis's band, right?
I think it's Bruce Willis's band that's sponsored by a candy bar, which makes it Hudson Hawk, I think. I haven't figured out all
or
of
the
angles.
Or is it Bruce Willis's cameo in Total Recall?
I don't think there are enough wine coolers at the concert for it to really be Bruce Willis's band, but we're still looking into that. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show,
I mean really like the show,
if you like the show more than we're gonna like talking about zombie lore on this episode, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear, which in the last month has included things like our Fantastic Fest wrap-up, a whole episode we did talking about haunted houses and laser quests. We've got an Alamode for Mandy, another Alamode coming up for Halloween. There's a shit ton of content that I think you guys will definitely enjoy. But all the business aside, it is time. You need a episode on Return of the Living Dead. We need a episode on Return of the Living Dead. And this is our episode on Return of the Living Dead.
Well, what you doing in there?
I don't know. It's unsure.
Well, what are we going to do? Lock it in, yeah!
Yes, so this was written and directed by Dan O'Bannon.
Legend.
And not just legend, but fucking legend. Yeah. He is your favorite screenwriter you don't realize is your favorite screenwriter. Like, he's that guy who just does not get mentioned enough. You know, of course, you know, wrote with John Carpenter early on Dark Star, worked on several big things that never took off, wrote on such unknown things as Alien, Heavy Metal, Blue Thunder, Total Recall, a couple of junk food favorites like
Life Force. Yeah.
And it's he's got such an interesting career, worked on so much really cool fucking shit.
And Life Force is actually the reason that he's directing his first movie, Return of the Living Dead.
Kind of. And that's the thing is what the real reason he's directing, because there's two reasons, because yes, you tugged on one of the things. One of the reasons is he got sick to fucking death of being a screenwriter in Hollywood and watching directors butcher his scripts. And he had just come off of Blue Thunder, and Blue Thunder was, the pitch of Blue Thunder is nuts. It's bonkers, and it's a movie I wish existed.
The helicopter's actually a shark, and Roy Scheider's trying to bring it down. The original draft, folks.
Better than that. I'm going to give you, here's the elevator pitch. Here's the elevator pitch that Dan O'Bannon used to give on Blue Thunder. It's Taxi Driver with a helicopter.
Oh, my God.
The LAPD were the bad guys in that version.
Yeah.
And he was so, here is this pilot, helicopter pilot with PTSD, given an experimental sci-fi helicopter, and has uncovered all of this corruption, and the LAPD is covering it up, and he snaps and goes to war with the LAPD.
It's just De Niro on the radio like, you chopping at me? You chopping at me? Well, I don't see anybody else here. You chopping at me?
The studio so neutered and watered down that thing, he actually said, and I'm quoting here, if I am either going to direct my next film or I am going to quit and become a fucking novelist or something.
Right.
And that was it. And so he was like, I'm done. He started putting some other stuff together. Actually, in the meantime, right after that, he helped do some consulting for the creature design work of Chud. And
are you referring to Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers?
That would be the very same Chud. Okay. And then
not Dennis Chud, currently running for a school board in Austin, right?
Right. And or Phil Chud, my cousin.
Yeah.
No, and so he
or the Chudley Cannons, an actual Quidditch team from the Harry Potter books.
No!
Folks, I'm just saying there's a lot of Chuds out there.
Yeah. Cinematic something under development.
Cinematic happenings.
Happenings under development. Yes. Yeah, so,
cinematic happenings until Devin, I believe, is the full abbreviation.
Something like that. So yeah. So he then had.
What's all these rubber bands doing? Oh, it's because we're inside the baseball. That's what all the rubber
bands
are doing.
That's what
here.
That is. So he then had two things in production. One was Toby Hooper's Life Force, which would come out in the same year. Mm. Which I love because it's an absolute inversion of Alien.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, the movie opens up with him blowing up the monster and that they found on a spaceship that had killed an entire alien race and then escaping in the escape pod. But as it turns out, that didn't kill the monster and he comes back after the alien has gotten to Earth. Like, it's fucking, it's the big what if of at the end of the movie Alien. So he had that going on with Toby Hooper, and then he made Return of the Living Dead.
Well, so in our crack research team put together a sheet for me, and I was reading it over, and from what I was reading, Tobe Hooper was the intended director for Return of the Living Dead, and they were going to shoot it in 3D. And then Tobe Hooper got so busy with doing Life Force that he was unavailable, and so Dan O'Bannon, tired, as you said, of people butchering his screenplays, comes in and completely rewrites the screenplay for this movie. And, like, there was... apparently, this was going to be a lot more like Night of the Living Dead. It was going to be a direct sequel, sort of 10 years later. It's in Pennsylvania, and the uprising of corpses happens again, and people start looting, and it was going to be about three sisters who were trying to protect their home from looters during, and then there was like a KGB subplot. There was a lot of weird shit.
By the way, just for those of you wondering how this could go so off the rails from that, long story short is originally
not the name of this podcast.
Night of the Living Dead was originally titled Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Yep, yep.
And when Romero took it to a theater to show it, they said, I can't put that up on the marquee. I can't put Flesh Eaters up there. And they kicked around ghouls and they kicked around stuff. And they said, well, what if we call it Night of the Living Dead? I'll put that on. So they quickly reshot a title card for Night of the Living Dead and forgot to put the copyright on it.
Yeah.
And because of that,
one of the great stories of how you protect your shit in Hollywood.
And it was an accident. They left it off. But because of that, it was, and because it was never addressed, it was legally in the public domain, which is how it ended up on cable so often, because it cost nothing because there were no rights to it. Romero lost all those rights, totally got fucked over by it, tried very hard to get them back over the years. Because he couldn't, anyone who wanted to make a sequel to Night of the Living Dead could totally make a sequel to Night of the Living Dead. And that's what initially they were going to do. And then O'Bannon went and said, you know what? Nobody wants to see a direct sequel to it. That's what Dawn of the Dead is. Let's make something for the 80s. And he really got what the 80s wanted and made this fucking classic that inspired others. Like, that's the thing, is the thing about O'Bannon is virtually everything he wrote got ripped off or turned it or sequelized. This was both, because without this, we don't have Evil Dead 2. Evil Dead 2 is not Evil Dead. It's Evil Dead after Raimi saw Return of the Living Dead and said, that's what these movies want to be. And without Evil Dead 2, we don't have Brain Dead, a.k.a.
Bad Taste.
No.
You're talking about the Peter Jackson movie.
Yes, which Bad Taste is the other Peter Jackson movie.
No, I know this. Brain Dead or... Fuck, no. No, it's not coming to my brain at all. But no, there's something else that's really interesting is, and this may be completely apocryphal, but something else that the IMDb turned up is that George Romero and his longtime writing producing partner, when they kind of parted ways, had this weird divorce agreement where one of them could continue making movies called something something of the Living Dead, and Romero could keep making movies as long as he just left off Living Dead. So that's why the sequel to Night of the Living Dead is not called Dawn of the Living Dead. It's just Dawn of the Dead and then Day of the Dead. Romero never calls them the Living Dead ever again, because apparently the agreement was you can call it whatever you want as long as it's not Living Dead. And the other partner would be able to call them Living Dead, which is why he went on to make the 90s version of Night of the Living Dead,
which was in hopes of getting back those rights.
Yes.
It's the whole reason they made it. It was not because they wanted to remake it, but the thought was if he produced it and they directed a new version, that would get them the rights back to the title. And it did not.
It did not work, as it turned out. Now, before we get into the plot of this movie,
there's a plot to this movie?
Very slight, but there is some plot to this movie. I want to just... what I think is crazy about Return of the Living Dead is it sits right in the middle of a timeline of events, three very specific events that completely change everyone's perception of what a zombie on screen is.
Yes.
This movie, to the genre, is actually one of the most important movies if you're a fan of zombie films.
Well, that's, yeah, because the thing is that the movie, one, is a meta film that acknowledges that the previous film existed,
yes,
as a film, and two, then proceeds to break every single rule that Romero lays out to create his own type of zombies. And from this point on, from 1985 on, whenever we talked about zombies, there were two branches. Now, this in this day and age, everybody pretty much accepts the rules of zombies are Romero's rules.
Well, but that's what's crazy is because the first event on this timeline is Night of the Living Dead, where Romero breaks all the rules, because at that point, a zombie was an instrument of Haitian voodoo revenge.
Well, because they never called them zombies, and he never called them zombies. He referred to them as ghouls.
Right.
And it was a French publication that first coined the phrase, you know, calling it a zombie movie.
Right.
And referred to them as zombies inappropriately, and it stuck.
Yes. And so that in and of itself is a huge departure from what audience had seen and understood a zombie is on screen. Landmark, absolutely.
Yeah.
Then you get almost 20 years later, 1985, this film, Return of the Living Dead, which gives us one of the most signature touchstones of zombies. In fact, even people who don't like horror, people who still know what a zombie is but don't watch horror movies, if you ask them to name three things that categorize a zombie, that define what a zombie is, one of the first things they're going to say is they eat brains. It's all about brains. You see so many t-shirts where brains this, and this is a zombie brain, you know, piece of kitsch on ThinkGeek. Like, everything zombie related is about brains. That had never occurred
until
prior
this movie.
To Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah, Return of the Living Dead created the whole zombies eat brains. Romero zombies do not eat brains. Romero zombies and every zombie that knocks off Romero zombies eat flesh. They don't care about brains.
It wasn't called Night of the Brain Eaters. It was called Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Yes. And so, yeah, that's one of the big rules they break. Also, people who don't know what they're talking about, and I'll just fucking lay that out right there, say that fast zombies originated in a little film called 28 Days Later. That is false. That is absolutely false. The zombies here are fast. In fact, many of the people that get killed get rushed by running fucking zombies.
Yes, which is true. The difference in Danny Boyle's film, which is for me the end of this timeline, is that the Danny Boyle zombies aren't just not shambling. Those motherfuckers are sprinting. It is like Usain Bolt. An undead legion of Usain Bolt is chasing you down the street. It is insane how fast a Danny Boyle zombie is. Which I still think, to your point, yes, the zombies in this movie absolutely are moving fast. There is still a bit of rule breaking going on in 28 Days Later, because those zombies are like inhumanly fast. It's like being chased down by the Flash as a zombie, which I believe is a Marvel comic run that I didn't read. So yeah, that's it. Like, so you have,
you just cross the stream so hard in my fucking room in the way that I am not, I Flash isn't in the Marvel universe, motherfucker.
Oh, did I say Marvel universe?
Marvel Zombies is a universe in the Marvel universe. There is a Marvel Zombie universe. The Flash is not in it.
Guys, I know comic books. I totally know comic books. I was talking about Flash Gordon.
You were talking about
Marvel Comics character. Come on, obviously. No, not even him.
All no, right. He's not in. No, Quicksilver. You could have, you know, as fast as Quicksilver in the Marvel Zombie universe.
What's it? Isn't that a car? Is a Quicksilver not a car?
No, Quicksilver's a bike messenger movie from the 1980s.
Okay, what's Vertigo Comics? What's that all about? Can we just, like, sidebar this entire show and you explain to me comics? Because I don't think I understand.
Sidebar! Sidebar!
The Vertigo universe is a mostly separate universe. It was an offshoot in the early 90s of all these cutting edge comic books. And it's where you had stuff like Sandman by Neil Gaiman and a lot of these weird oddball comics. Preacher was a Vertigo comic. It was essentially kind of this dark side universe of just cool shit that all kind of danced in and out of each other.
Yeah, and guys, sheathe your tweets. I know that the Flash is not part of the Marvel Universe. I don't care.
Let him know what you feel about that. Like, send him tweets.
This is not called junk food comic books. I don't fucking care.
This is junk food kick Brian in the balls over comic books.
That's the thing you're going to try to kick me in the balls about, you are going to be very disappointed, because I don't give a shit. But I do give a shit about Return of the Living Dead, which, like...
Were we talking about that?
We were. And I want to talk about something else with this movie that was a revelation to me this time watching it for the show. This stars one of the great legends of B-movies, Clue Gulager.
Clue Gulager, baby. Speaking of movies I can't believe we haven't done yet, we haven't done The Killers yet.
We have not done The Killers yet. Either version of The Killers we haven't done. I feel like we should kind of do a double episode and talk about both versions of that movie.
By the way, if you've never watched Don Siegel's 1964 The Killers, where Lee Marvin and Clue Gulager play fucking hitmen going around in a Rashomon-like story, slapping the fuck out of people to get the dirt on where $1 million is, also starring Ronald fucking Reagan and John Cassavetes, you have missed out. Watch that movie and then understand why Clue Gulager's so fucking cool.
Well, now I'm gonna shoot you in the face and That'll be all.
Dude, when Ronald Reagan smacks the shit out of Angie Dickinson,
where's the jelly
beans? It hurts my childhood.
Where did you hide the jelly beans? I want to know. You're going to tell me right now, mother. It's a very interesting movie, both versions, in fact. But this is what was revelatory to me about watching it this time.
What was revelatory to you, Brian?
I had labored under the delusion that Clue Gulager was the older technician or the older warehouse manager who ends up like incinerating himself. I had for years thought that guy was Clue Gulager.
No.
I in fact was clueless as to who Gulager was in the first place because I always thought that guy was Clue Gulager. Turns out that is not at all Clue Gulager.
No, and Clue Gulager's son directed the Feast series.
That's why he's in all three of them.
Yes.
He
got to work with his dad.
I see now. Also, it's one of the most fun actor names to say.
Clue Gulager?
It sounds like a gelatinous alien from another universe.
Dude, Clue came down a couple of times to Fantastic Fest for various things. And what a cool fucking guy he is.
Cool Gulager.
Cool Gulager, baby. Yeah, no, he was... No, he. One of my favorite things we were talking... Because he was just one of those working actors back during the end of the studio days where you would just, you know, you would get a call, you know, you'd go to work every day. It's like, what are we doing? It's like, oh, today you're going to be an extra in a cowboy show and you're going, okay, you know, and today you're going to be in a crowd scene over here. All right. Like he was one of those. And we were talking about some things and I realized he was working at the same time at the same studio as Charles Bronson. I'm like, did you ever work with Charles Bronson? He goes, Charlie. Ah, we all worked with Charlie. And he went on to tell this story about, you know, getting to work with Charles Bronson, but he was Charlie and he was just this down to earth guy that was like just doing whatever work they could when they worked together. He wasn't a big guy at the time. He was just one of those day players who would come in and work and they would all do commissary together. And he talked about how exciting it was to watch, you know, Charlie come up from those ranks and go on to be a star. And so I figured that might be a... Considering how often you do that impression...
I don't know what you're talking about. I have no recollection. Look, only one person in the history of time was allowed to call me Charlie.
I'm just saying.
Cool Gulager.
And Cool Gulager in Family of Cops 4. Because we know how much you love Family of Cops.
He was the Uncle Cop. Uncle Clue, we called him in Family of Cops. Came from another planet, was made of jello. It was weird. I will do that impression until the day I die. By the way, fucking sidebar.
Sidebar!
Are you aware that there is a Polish actor working right now whose entire shtick is that he looks exactly like Charles Bronson?
No.
They made a movie called Death Kiss. With like, I can't remember if it's Daniel Baldwin or one of the Baldwins is in it. It is a movie made for about $12. But in the trailer, you see this guy who looks so eerily like Charles Bronson that you will swear to God they found a way to resurrect him. Like a zombie Charles Bronson in this movie. It is fucking unnerving.
Send more Family of Cops.
Send more cops from my family. I'm just saying, if you got a death wish, it's fine. We'll resurrect you. We got lots of these drums. Yeah, no, it's fucking weird. I highly encourage you all to look up the trailer for the movie Death Kiss because It is a shameless remake ripoff of Death Wish with a Polish actor whose only claim to fame is that he looks exactly like Charles Bronson. So, Return of the Living Dead, the basic story is that James Karen, who's the guy that I spent years thinking was Clu Gulager, who is not Clu Gulager, and Tom Matthews, who is an alum of Junk Food Cinema because he is he's one of the three actors who plays the only through-line character in any Friday the 13th movies. He plays Tommy Jarvis. He plays Tommy Jarvis in Part 6. He's the one out in the boat who's like, "Come on, Jason, you pussy!" Like, he's in that one. He's in the zombie Jason movie. This guy is all about being in zombie movies.
Zombie comedies, by the way. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing is, are you doing a zombie comedy in the mid-80s? Because Tom Matthews is available.
Frighteningly available, in fact. He is, it's a little unsettling how constantly available he is. But yeah, James Karen is a guy who's been in a lot of movies I feel like qualify as junk food, like Hercules in New York. He was in the 95 Piranha. He's in Behind Enemy Lines. He's in Apt Pupil, Any Given Sunday, Mulholland Drive.
Oh, yeah. No, he was an actor who was just around.
Yeah.
He was just one of those guys that character actor. He was one of those guys.
Yeah, exactly. So he's the two of them, Tom Matthews, James Karen, work in this medical supply company called UNITA, which I thought was very, very clever pun there. UNITA Medical Supplies. And right off the bat, and actually Ebert pointed this out in his review, and I think it's so ballsy. This movie knows that it's called Return of the Living Dead, and that the assumption is going to be that it's a sequel or somehow related to Night of the Living Dead or Dawn of the Dead. This was 1985. So wasn't this the same year that Day of the Dead came out? Mm-hmm. 1985? So people were going to assume it was part of that universe. So instead of trying to skirt around that at all, James Karen, about 5 minutes into this movie, literally starts a speech by saying, "Did you ever see that movie, Night of the Living Dead?" And it's like, okay, all right. So we are just going to acknowledge it head on.
And we're going to acknowledge that, oh no, that really happened. But they messed up all the details because you know how they make movies and they got to lie about stuff and change things and legal stuff. And yet essentially hand waving like, but that story isn't how it happened. Like, here's, you know, this movie's going to be the real story of what happened.
So what he explains really happened is some kind of chemical. There was a chemical spill at a hospital and it leaked down into the morgue and the chemical caused the bodies to kind of get up. And they actually have some of those bodies downstairs. And so they go down and there are these barrels that in fact have human corpses in them. And he's like, oh, these are military grade. They'll never leak. And he hits one. And right as he hits it, wouldn't you know, some kind of gas sprays them both in the face. And this kicks off the movie. It also kicks off one of the greatest horror theme songs of the 80s. Like, the fucking music in this movie is going to be a recurring theme of this episode.
Well, I mean, that is, yeah, it's a really interesting thing what O'Bannon did is O'Bannon fused punk and the punk scene in with this very punk rock fucking movie.
Yeah.
Like, this is a scrappy little film that knows exactly what the fuck it is and isn't trying to be cinema. It's trying to be an enjoyable fucking Friday night at the movies. And he creates this amazing fucking soundtrack out of just a bunch of the best working punk bands at the time and a handful of classics. And it is just great. And it's one of those soundtracks that has remained one of the great soundtracks of all time.
Yeah. And not the least of which being, I mean, this opening, just orchestral, like very synth, very raucous, just like, Meryl, just play a little bit of it. I don't need to try and imitate it. That song is so fucking good. And then from there, we get a lot of, I can't remember what they call it, like dead punk, or it was like a specific genre of punk music that was very macabre and very, it's like the, whatever the death metal.
Chupa macabre,
yeah, which is my porn name.
Chupa mi verga.
Heyo. I don't know what's happening, but yeah. So this. No. Let's take a minute.
Let's take a minute. I almost crossed a line there, and I'm like, yeah. You know what? That's a line I'm not going to cross.
Which, by the way, props for growing up and showing some. Like, I would not have expected you to show restraint on this show. I am a little taken aback, I have to say. But there's so much great punk music in this, and we mentioned one already. The song "Do You Wanna Party?" Because it's party time.
It's party time. It is the most 80s you can get.
It really fucking
like
is.
It's like yes, that is exactly what every party song in the 80s. You were either partying. It was either party time. You were partying all night and sleeping all day, or
kick it,
or everybody was Wang Chunging.
Was it prior to people having to fight for their right to party?
Yes, because you didn't have to fight for your right to party until later in the 80s. Well, I think it was 87 where we had to actually fight for our right to party. In 85, it was party time.
I was in the Killers, and then I passed anti-party legislation once I became president, and then people had to fight for their right to party. That's how it works.
No, in fact, the beauty of... trip to the sidebar...
Sidebar!
Fight for your right to party. Beastie Boys hate that song. And they hate that song because that song was a parody of these types of songs. And they were literally making fun. It's why it comes after Girls on the album. It's the songs where they're just fucking around. And they had to play it for years because it was their biggest hit. And then they stopped playing it altogether and just would refuse because they're like, no, we fucking hate that song. You guys are listening to it unironically, and it was meant to be listened to ironically.
I feel like in the history of music, there are 30 stories exactly like that where artists were like, it was supposed to be a joke. Oh, you're taking it seriously? It sold how many copies? All right, fine.
Wait, it sold our entire album, and as a result, now Brass Monkey is everybody's favorite song off this album? All right, I'll fucking take it.
We'll take that Brass Monkey that platinum album.
For a while, that was the fucked up thing about License to Ill, is in the late 80s and early 90s, if you heard something on the radio from that album, you were hearing Girls or you were hearing Fight for Your Right to Party. You didn't hear Brass Monkey on the radio until much later.
I just remembered a classic example of exactly this thing, is that Sting, to this day, is horrified that people use Every Breath You Take as their wedding songs.
Oh, yes.
He's like, do you guys not listen to the rest of that song? Because it's definitely not romantic.
Yeah, that's not a sweet song.
Like, that's a creep couple. I'm sorry. If you're at a wedding and their first dance is Every Breath You Take, reconsider your friends. Because holy shit, are they missing the point.
So, Return of the Living Dead. Stargrove!
So that's movie A, is James Caron and Tom Matthews dealing with this gas getting out of the barrel, and suddenly everything in the medical supply warehouse is coming to life, all the cadavers are getting up. Movie B is demons happening outside, where a group of punks and new wave weirdos, the exact mix, by the way, of demons, where it's like, okay, I definitely see the punks, I also see a lot of new wave kids in this group, it's strange, are all just trying to have a party. They're literally waiting for Tom Matthews to get off work and looking for anywhere to party, and they end up going to a cemetery, where...
Which is just across the street. It's not like, you know, it's not like, hey, we got nothing to do, let's do this. It's like, well, hey, dude, there's a cemetery over there, let's go hang out across the street while we wait for Tom.
Yeah, whose name in this movie, I believe, is Freddy. If I'm remembering correctly.
Probably.
By the way, Freddy has a jacket, and this is one of my favorite stories about this movie. He has a jacket in this movie that says, fuck you, on the back. And then Dan O'Bannon realized that while he loved it, they could never show this on TV if his jacket said, fuck you. So there's literally a version of this movie where he reshot all those scenes, and the jacket says, television version, on the back. So if you saw this movie on TV... Freddie's wearing a jacket that on the back says television version.
Also, that sounds exactly like O'Bannon's sense of humor. At the same time, where were they ever going to show this movie on TV? This is not, it's first of all, Linnea who? She's not in the movie. Like, why is there a character there for the first 5 minutes of the movie and then she vanishes for the rest of the film? Why does that happen? I don't know. You can't show anything that the zombies actually do. There's so many fucking F-bombs in this movie that, you know, you'd have to... you'd have to find a stranger in the Alps over and over again. This is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps. This is, you know, I don't know how O'Bannon ever thought this was going to get any kind of TV play that wasn't late night on HBO, because that's exactly where it fucking played
Still my favorite TV edit of all time is that Big Lebowski scene. This is what happens, Larry. This is what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps. And it's like, guys, I understand it matches up with what he's saying on his lips, but the fuck are you talking about?
Do you not realize that the people that had to do this had so much fucking fun coming up with the dumbest shit to come out of people's mouths? It was a sport. I guarantee you that guy still gets beers bought off of the fact that it's like, oh, best thing I ever did at work. I'm the guy who created Finding Strangers in the Alps.
Yeah, this is very true. And I remember one movie. I can't remember what it was called, but there was a character named Shaughnessy. And in the TV version, every time somebody said bullshit, they said Bull Shaughnessy, even if Shaughnessy wasn't in the room and they weren't being spoken to. Yeah, no, it's pretty great. TV edits are actually pretty fun when you...
But how we're... Now I kind of want to watch the version with that on his jacket.
Television version. And then the movie's about 10 minutes long. It's like trying to watch Scarface on Spike TV. Why did they ever do that? That's why that network is dead, by the way. It's because they thought it was a good idea to put Scarface on network TV. It's a 5-minute cut. Come on, guys.
Yeah, it's like the family version of... I have a friend who actually does a family-friendly version of Pulp Fiction, and it's 5 minutes long. He performs it.
Hey, it's Family of Pulp Fiction. It's about 5 minutes long, and I only kill like 13 people, so it's a real step down from my usual body count. But movie B is this, like, super punk, awesome horror movie going on, kind of in waiting for the movies to join up again. You know, speaking of Pulp Fiction, these two movies are going to hardcore cross over, but we're just waiting for that to happen. And you mentioned her already, but let's talk about Linnea Quigley, who is another legend of B-movies, for sure.
Well, yeah, she was, she's still around. She is a B-movie actress who was in incredible shape in the 80s. Like, she put out a tongue-in-cheek workout tape, which is literally just an hour of Linnea Quigley showering. It is one of the most uncomfortable...
I've seen the television version of that.
No, I found the Linnea Quigley workout tape online.
Oh, I'm sure you just stumbled across it one day.
No, because I was going through her filmography at one point, and I was like, wait, a workout tape? What? And I Googled it, and there were links, and I was like, all right, let's... She's just showering.
Yeah.
Like, it's an hour. And then, she ends up running around the house and Skippy stuff and monsters try to get her. And it's very, it is very tongue-in-cheek.
Wait, there's a narrative to her
workout tape? Because it's, again, this is why I'm bringing this up. Because it's, like, she was just having a lot of fun. And she was, as we've talked about in the past, the horror community is one of the close-knit communities in Hollywood. Everybody knows each other. Everybody likes each other. If you're an asshole, a jerk, or a creep, you get run out on a rail. Nobody wants to fucking deal with you. And you can just be like, shit, we're putting together a movie in my backyard. Who can we call? Who's not working? And you call up Linnea and she'll be like, yeah, sure, I'll come. And she would come and do almost anything. And as they talked about with Slime Bowl Bolarama, you know, they wanted her for another role, but she was always interested in playing the nasty characters, the mean characters, she wanted some depth to what she was doing. She had a lot of fun doing that. She loved being hated on screen. She was fine with that. She just wanted to do something interesting.
Let's run down, and Meryl, get that bell sound ready, because I'm just going to run down the movies that she's been in that either have been covered on the show or are worthy of being covered on the show. Here we go. How about Death Sport? How about Tourist Trap? How about Savage Streets? How about Silent Night, Deadly Night? This movie, of course, that we're talking about. How about Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master? How about Dead Heat? How about Night of the Demons? I could literally go on and on and on and on and on. Also, she is in the movie that has become legendary around these halls, Jacko, featuring one of the greatest commentaries of all time.
Jacko, not a movie we will ever cover because the movie is terrible. However, we'll go on and on about the craziest fucking director commentary of all time. Let's just do it in one take, even if the director walks out on the producer and then comes back and the producer mocks him and they like talk shit about each other for the last 20 minutes. How about that as a commentary? You don't ever need to watch the movie Jacko, but buy it and turn on the director's commentary. And you, if you don't want to watch the whole thing, start right where the scenes are, the thunderstorm, because that's where, oddly enough, the shot of the storm is right when the storm starts brewing.
Yeah, it's between the producer and the director.
And it is one of the most glorious, cringeworthy things you've ever listened to in your entire life.
Let's just put it this way. If we did a whole episode on that show, the junk food pairing would be a shit pickle.
We discussed this commentary before we ever got into this, and you specifically stated you would not make any reference to the shit pickle comment.
Let's just throw it out there and leave it at that.
Fucking shit pickle. Oh, there's like, you know what?
How has that not become a thing on this show?
Because there's literally only one person laughing right now, and it's fucking Joe Lynch. Joe Lynch is laughing his ass off at shit pickle.
That fucking shit pickle loves that joke.
Well, he's at, you know what? The reason why is Joe is the guy who introduced us to Jacko. So
this is true.
All credit to Lynch for this whole bit that we've just done.
I do very much remember that particular marathon. But also in this gang of punks is Miguel Nunez Jr., who in and of himself is kind of a junk food alum. He has been in, let's see, he was in, well, not, I guess not a junk food alum in terms of movies that we've covered, but he's definitely, for example, in a Friday the 13th sequel. He is in not 6, unfortunately, but 5, which is where, what's his name, Roy? The
ambulance driver, yeah.
Oh my God, is actually...
Yeah, we're not a fan of 5.
Not a fan of 5, but has been in movies like Scooby-Doo, has been in movies like Street Fighter, has been... And what's crazy is I remember him from movies like from that era, from the 90s, but he actually showed up in movies in the like in the 2000s and looked the exact same age. So I never knew how old he was. Because he would turn up in movies like Return of the Living Dead and look exactly the same age as he was like in the mid-2000s in movies like Joanna Man. It's like, wait, did this guy like...
Wait, did we become the first podcast in history to reference Joanna Man?
Welcome back to Joanna Cast, the podcast where we spend 37 episodes talking about Joanna Man. He's also in Lethal Weapon 3, Action Jackson, motherfucker. Like, yeah, this guy was in a lot of movies that we definitely... would talk about. Starlight! And I actually just realized something. There is a character in this punk group named Suicide, because of course, who's got some of the best lines where he's like, everybody thinks this is just an outfit or a costume. It's a way of life. And he's like, totally fucking talking about like the punk movement. And he's like, people say I'm spooky. What the fuck? That guy is also in Friday the 13th Part 5. He's the guy that actually hacks up the fat kid in Friday the 13th Part 5. So it's a little bit of a, well, I think both these movies actually came out in the same year. So Miguel Nunez and the guy who plays Suicide are just palling around all these horror movies. So,
well, I mean, and particularly in this era when it was so lucrative, but there wasn't a, you know, no one took it seriously. Like, this is where, you know, the studio still ghettoized horror, and horror was just for teenagers and creepy dudes who wore all black. Yeah. Like, it was not something meant for general audiences. It wasn't like the 70s where you'd make The Exorcist or The Omen and it was a, you know, it was serious horror cinema. No, this was seedy, and they felt bad about it. And so as a result, you had this small little ghetto of people who would just all fucking make these movies together. And that's what's kind of great about it, because they've all stayed friends for like 35 fucking years. Shout out again to Joe Lynch. If you guys don't listen to, if you have not had a chance to check out It's the Movie Crypt, the deep cuts these guys do into the careers of a number of these folks, I guarantee you there's got to be a Linnea Quigley in there somewhere. Like,
yeah.
If they haven't done Linnea Quigley, it's because Linnea was rude to one of them, and they were just like, fuck Linnea.
Hey,
but
Joe,
I doubt that.
Joe, you shit pickle. If you're listening to me right now, you better do a Linnea Quigley episode. God damn it.
I've certainly probably have. Like, yeah. They've interviewed everyone. It's what's so fucking great about that.
I feel like two of the most iconic things about this movie, one is Linnea Quigley's, I will just call it a Dance of the Dead, where she is so turned on by the concept of death that she just strips off her clothes and just does this dance on top of a tomb.
Full frontal, which was no bueno in the 80s. Like, that's what this movie got really kind of known for.
Kind of full frontal. And that's a weird story because apparently the day they shot this movie, one of the producers was on set and saw Linnea Quigley just fully nude with her pubic hair and was like, are you crazy? Like, you can't show pubic hair in a movie, Dan.
Right.
What are you doing? So Dan's like, okay, fine. And he makes Linnea Quigley shave.
Yeah.
And then she comes back and the same producer's like, that's worse. Now you can see everything. And Linnea Quigley's like, she tells a story where she's like, I didn't mind being naked. I did mind being forced to shave. It was just that somehow made it weirder. And so they fitted her with this.
A merkin.
No, it was like a application that she would wear that was basically a flesh colored. It almost looked like the bottom of swim trunks, but it was like a makeup application.
Yes,
that made it look like she was naked, but she actually.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, no, they have. This is what a lot of actors have done for a long time. Hate to pull the veil back a little too far, but yeah, no. Generally, they will have this makeup that makes it look like it's them, but it's not, so that you can get away with it. And that's why this is so, there's something unnerving about it in how it works in this scene because of the way it is. And how, if you even glance at it, it's like, that doesn't look right.
But I will say, until I read that, when our research team sent me the information, I never noticed it before. In my head, every time I'd watch this, she was just naked. And then as soon as I found that out and watched it, I couldn't not see it. Like, it's one of those things that once you see it, once you know it's there, it will never not be there again. So I'm sorry to burst some bubbles out there, but she's technically not fully nude, but all but fully nude in this
movie. Everybody
at
the time sure as fuck thought she was. And that's why, again, that was what this was known for. Like, anytime you'd mention Return of the Living Dead, one of your friends would go, Linnea Quigley.
Yeah.
The thing is that she does that, and the thing is that she's incredibly liberated. Like, she's not bothered by the fact. Like, it's for her, she's just doing her thing, and everyone else is like, yeah, right on. But she's just fucking doing it.
That character spends the rest of the movie, even in Crisis, with no pants.
Yes.
Yeah.
She ends up getting killed and eaten, and despite getting eaten, doesn't have bite marks over her, and then becomes a demon-like zombie.
Dude,
of her own.
If you're going to have a beautiful, like, let's use this analogy. If you're going to have a beautiful, like, classic car in a movie, why the fuck would you have people put scratches on it? I totally understand why zombie Linnea Quigley has no bite marks on her, so she continued to be gorgeous naked Linnea Quigley. I get it. But the other iconic thing about this movie is the oil drum zombie, who is the first, in fact, in the movie to call out that he's after brains. But that actor was a Jim Henson puppeteer. And holy shit, is his physical performance in that makeup amazing. Like, I actually, as I was watching it, I was like, you know, the only other person that I think to this day, oh my gosh, what a great physical performance in that costume like that, is the dancer who played the xenomorph at the end of Alien. And it was like, oh, well, that makes total fucking sense. Of course, those are the two things that are clicking together in my head. But yeah, his whole movement and the way he kind of throws his shoulders forward. And like, it's so, like, it's funny. This is definitely a horror comedy, but there are a couple of different moments in this movie that I remember seeing it as a kid, like flipping through channels, and couldn't finish it because I was too freaked out. And this zombie and the way he moves in the basement is one of the reasons I couldn't finish it as a kid.
Oh yeah, no, he's totally gross. He is really, like, it's really weird. And frankly, what's fascinating about it is if you strip all the like oily guck off him,
yeah,
he looks almost exactly like the vampire zombies in Life Force.
Yeah.
It's so totally cool. And that. Like, there's several movies around here that all use the same kind of design, and then it was totally abandoned. And so there's this small era where zombies are like these weird, emaciated, big-eyed things. It's really fucking cool. Like, it's such a weird, creepy aesthetic. Like, it's just like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's like, you know, no, this isn't, it, what's great about it, this isn't somebody covered in some, you know, blood makeup. This isn't some digital replacement. This is a fucking, this is makeup and puppet. Like, it's just this weird kind of creepy fucking thing that has always haunted me.
There's so many unnerving puppets in this movie. So many. But Alan Trautman is that actor's name who plays the tar zombie. And apparently they used Methocel for the tar, which is the, it's the additive they put in McDonald's shakes so they never actually have to, there's no dairy in them, so they never have to store them cold. Methocel is basically the thickening agent of McDonald's milkshakes. It's also what they use to make the blob from the blob. So
next time you drink a McDonald's milkshake, remember,
beware of the shake. It creeps inside of you and causes cancer, probably. Yeah, but Alan Trautman, just a fucking amazing performance as this tar zombie. And then the rest of the movie basically is Tom Matthews.
I love how somewhere out there, one of our listeners was sipping on a McDonald's milkshake.
And he slowly put it down and questioned his life choices.
Like, guys,
if you're listening to us,
fucked up my lunch.
I'm sorry. If you're listening to us, I think you need to question your life choices in the first place. But if you're also drinking, like, you know what's going to be crazy are the people who, like, go back and listen to this and it's already, like, March of next year and they've got a nice shamrock shake and they're just like, oh, I was looking forward to this since October. And fuck, now I can't even. God damn you, Junk Food Cinema. How dare you? Yes, James Caron and Tom Matthews.
I'm surprised that's not our slogan.
It should be. God damn you, Junk Food Cinema.
How dare you?
James Caron and Tom Matthews are now trying to get rid of this body, this cadaver that has come to life.
Oh, wait, are you still trying to explain the plot?
Yes.
We're like 50 minutes into this podcast.
We're about to the end of the episode, but yes, there's a plot. So they're trying to get rid of this cadaver so there's no evidence. And Clu Gulager plays the guy who actually owns the warehouse, and he's called in as well. And they burn all of the pieces of this body that came to life. And wouldn't you know it, that causes a cloud, which causes a rain that leaks down into the cemetery. All the bodies start coming to life and eating our cast members. Linnea Quigley actually has a great line earlier in the movie where she's like talking about how, don't you ever get turned on by death and thinking about the ways to die. She's like, I think the worst way to die would be a bunch of old men just grabbing and biting and ripping me apart. And then, of course, that's what happens to her. So you sow the seed and then, you know, you reap the murder scene. And then she, of course, comes back as another horrifying puppet in this movie. There's a scene where she eats a dude's head and it looks like Gina Davis in Beetlejuice. Like, her head is just like six sizes taller than it should be. And then when the fucking ambulance shows up and the paramedics start getting eaten, there is I assume it's someone with actual, some kind of amputee or something playing one of the zombies that has no legs.
Oh, absolutely.
Fucking, like, who fucking called Todd Browning in here to do this scene? Because I am like, freaking out right now. And I remember that scene really fucked me up as a kid. Because I saw that, like, flipping through, and I was like, I don't want anything more to do with this movie. I am out. And then there's the scene where the zombies are trying to come through the door, and they hack one of them in half, and the top half of this female old woman zombie with pink hair is just thrashing around. Like, her head's thrashing around, her spinal column's thrashing around, and she's the one that explains that, like, it hurts to be dead, and eating the brains, like alleviates the pain. It's just like,
and that creepy little spine that's always like whipping around.
No, I do not care for this. I do not care for it. There is one weird story element that was apparently supposed to be played up, and most of it got excised, but there is a lot of it left. So there's the character of the mortician, who. There's a lot of weird things about this guy, but apparently in the early drafts or the early shoots, his character was supposed to be a Nazi in hiding.
So here's a thing about Dan O'Bannon. I've never seen anybody reference this before, but if there is a doctor or a medical examiner of some sort, someone from the medical profession in a Dan O'Bannon movie, they're the bad guy. Or they are a bad guy. Alien, the bad guy. Dead and Buried, the fucking bad guy. Like, if there's ever a doctor, Dan O'Bannon was a lifelong sufferer of Crohn's disease, and was in and out of hospitals a lot. He once had a stomach ache so terrible, it felt like some kind of monster or alien was trying to burst out of his stomach, and thus a legend was born. That's where he got the idea for Alien.
Oh, wow.
And so there is a through line of complete distrust of medical professionals in every single one of his films. The doctors are always to blame. They're always the bad guys.
Well, in Alien, the doctor was a robot that went, yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. No, you're right. You're
dead.
Right, you're
dead
right.
And buried. The mortician is the one resurrecting the dead.
Yeah.
Life Force. The psychiatrist is the one where she's hiding in the body. You can never trust in The Resurrected. His Dan O'Bannon's only other film, which is a remake of The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. It's an evil doctor who has learned how to resurrect himself. Like, it's for some reason. And O'Bannon had it fucking out for doctors. And sure enough, this was always the sticking point for me where it's like, this guy's clearly not on the up and up, but he's not bad. Oh, wait, he's a Nazi.
Yeah, there's stuff like he's listening to German Panzer music on his Walkman while he embalms bodies. He carries a German Walther P-38. He even has a picture of fucking Eva Braun in his morgue. And during the film refers to the rainstorm as coming down like, Ein Betrunken Soldat, which means a drunken soldier in German? What the fuck? What the fuck? Like, there's distrust of doctors, and then there's like, this guy is apparently in The Boys from fucking Brazil. What is going on?
Par for the course for O'Bannon. Like, you've seen Dead and Buried, right?
Yeah, I get the theme. I guess it's just a very, very specific choice for this mortician.
Well, I mean, there's only so many ways you can make your doctor evil before you have to get to Nazis.
Did you just say Dr. Evil and we weren't talking about Austin Powers?
That is exactly. I said Doctor's Evil,
there
plural.
You go. All right, good. Thank God. Dodge that bullet. By the way, one thing that doesn't get discussed much in this movie is that it takes place in Louisville, Kentucky. Which is apparently a very deep cut reference to The Crazies, another George Romero movie, where one of the
guys... We have talked about.
One of the guys says in The Crazies, the infection has spread to Louisville. Because, as we all know, much of the Romero canon takes place in Pennsylvania. Kentucky and Pennsylvania not that far apart.
Hence, Pennsyltucky.
Pennsyltucky. Or growing up... I had relatives who really hated people from Noblesville, Indiana, and would refer to that as Nobletucky. So, like, it's just, if you wanted to insult a place, you just added Tucky to the end of it, evidently. We also didn't mention that Linnea Quigley's character name is Trash, making her the second character we've covered in the run of the show called Trash.
At least.
There might be a third.
There's probably some more trash out there. This is a podcast loaded with trash.
We pick up a lot of trash, Junk Food Cinema. Look for that in our T Public store. This movie just gets fucking crazier and crazier. James Caron and Tom Matthews, because of their exposure to this gas, are slowly becoming zombies. One of my favorite scenes in this movie, which is like a lot of unexpected gravitas, actually, is when James Caron decides that he doesn't want to become a zombie and he'd rather just end it all, and literally just slowly climbs into a crematorium and incinerates himself alive. And it's just like, and the thing that really gets me about that scene is like, he takes off his wedding ring before he does it and like sets it aside. And it's just like, it's kind of this really sweet moment that like, I'm sorry, I was just watching a comedy where like 20 cops got eaten by zombies. And then you have this really like, deep, meaningful scene. Like, good on you, Dan O'Bannon.
O'Bannon's a fucking genius, man. I mean, O'Bannon, he made one film in the 1980s that didn't involve the undead. and every single film is radically different.
Yeah.
He's got such a large body of work that, because he started out in the 70s, it was all science fiction all the time. And then the 80s, outside of Invaders from Mars, was all fucking, he wrote some other sci-fi stuff, but it didn't get made until the 90s, you know. Total Recall didn't happen until 1990. And then two of his older scripts that were in development, Hell, ended up getting made as Screamers and Bleeders. But other people rewrote him, and that's why we're not going to cover those films.
We're good. Thanks.
But he dealt with the undead a lot. And he had... One of the only through lines with all of these films is that there is no mortal wound for the undead. There is no shooting him in the head. You have to destroy the zombie. That's the only way to kill a zombie because, as Dan O'Bannon states here in this film, you can't kill what's already dead. And that's every single film from the B-17 sequence in Heavy Metal to Dead and Buried to the vampire things in Life Force to all the way to his second film, the directed film, The Resurrected. He was all about... You don't shoot a fucking zombie.
Scene in this movie where Clu Gulager buries a pickaxe in the brain of an animated cadaver, and it's still kicking and moving around, and then they cut the head off, and the body gets up and starts running around.
Yeah, and that is a running through line through all of his films, that you don't stop the living dead. That's where he really diverges from Romero and does something cool and different.
Well, and they talk. The zombies talk in this movie. Like we mentioned, the puppet that explains why they eat brains, and then the running joke of send more cops, send more paramedics. I also love that at one point, it's clearly a Civil War general who says send more cops. So despite being dead since the 1800s, he's figured out exactly how to use a CB radio. So good.
Well, and one of the living dead is actually just a skeleton. Like there's no laws of physics to this whatsoever. There's no rationale. It's just fun. It's just a creep show story. And that is very much what this movie is it is Dan O'Bannon's creep show.
True story. Did you ever see Two, Return of the Living Dead Part Two? Or have you seen any of the other sequels?
Oh, God, yes. I've seen all of the other sequels. I think the only one I haven't seen is like one of the last ones they made in 2005 because they made
Necropolis.
They made like five sequels. Yeah, Two is terrible.
Okay.
Two is unwatchable.
I disagree with that, but I don't think it's great.
Three, on the other hand, is.
Interesting.
Three is cool. Have you seen Three?
No, is that the one that, like, the Rave of the Dead or something?
No. Three is the one where the military now has complete control of the eggs. They've got the gas, and this guy is on a motorcycle ride with his girlfriend, gets into an accident, she flies off the back, gets killed. And he's so heartbroken over the death of his girlfriend, he takes her in and exposes her. And she discovers that she can control her desire to kill by hurting herself. And so she's slowly over the movie inserting nails and glass and whatever into her own body so that she can maintain control and not become a mindless zombie.
If only that motorcycle guy had had Fred Gwynne to tell him about why you don't do that and why the soil of a man's heart is... You know what? I can't do a Fred Gwynne impression, so for all intents and purposes...
Matt, do it as if it were from an episode of Family of Cops.
Look, sometimes dead is better, especially if they got a death wish. That's all I'm... You know what? I made Death Wish 5. Clearly, I'm an example of why dead is better sometimes.
Oh.
Just saying. Guys, that brings us
Rambo 5, 2019. Let's go.
Let's not. Why are they doing... Okay, Rambo, as ridiculous as that movie is, has a great ending that wraps up the entire franchise better than most franchises get.
I concur.
Why are they doing... God damn it. Anyway, junk food pairing.
I mean, McDonald's milkshakes.
I feel like that's got to be.
That's got to be the go-to, right? Like a nice vanilla chocolate swirl.
Yes. And in case we did that one already in the Blob episode, because I don't remember what we actually did for the Blob episode, I'm also going to recommend, because I was actually struggling with this, and then I looked up some local culinary favorites for the city of Louisville. And what I found is something called, and I swear to God.
Sluggers, right?
It's called a hot brown. And now I realize I should not say those words to you because you're just.
Wait, no. No, my body is ready. Tell me about a hot brown, Brian. Give me a Kentucky hot brown.
Stop.
It's got to be different from an Alabama hot pocket, right?
I realize what a terrible idea this is.
This has been a bad idea from the beginning.
It's like when you pull out into traffic and you look over and you're like, oh, there was a car coming. I shouldn't have done this. But the whole time you were about to accelerate, you're like, this is the right move. This is the right move.
Let's talk about a Kentucky hot brown.
So a Kentucky hot brown is an open-faced sandwich of turkey and bacon covered in cheese. Usually, if you get the low-rent version, it's like a nacho cheese and baked until the bread is crisp and the sauce begins to brown. Usually includes ham with the turkey and bacon, tomatoes, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not even going to go into the history. I don't fucking feel like talking anymore about the Kentucky hot brown. But if we ever open a restaurant for Junk Food Cinema, it's the first thing that's going on the fucking menu.
You know what? I have another suggestion.
Yes.
Menudo.
Menudo? Like with Ricky Martin, and they replace them every few years if they get too old and...
Or am I... No, no, no. You know what? I'm saying menudo. I'm thinking barbacoa.
Oh, yeah.
Barbacoa face tacos.
Meat. Face meat. Yeah.
Which one is the brains? Because that's what I'm going for here.
I mean, in this outfit, it's me, but I'm not sure which...
There are cow brain tacos, and you can pretty much only get them on the weekends.
I think barbacoa is made from the cheek of pigs, so I don't think that's brains. But like fried brain sandwiches, I believe, actually, our research team brought that to my attention, that you can still, in some places in the Midwest, you can get fried brain sandwiches is a thing you can actually get. Or sometimes they call it eggs and brains. Our researcher said that he actually ordered eggs and brains in high school because he thought it was a gimmick name for the dish and not actually brains. It wasn't terrible, but he hasn't eaten it again.
Sessos. They're called Sessos.
Okay. So if you don't want a Kentucky hot brown with your shamrock shake, Sessos, perhaps.
A cow brain taco. I kind of feel like if you're going to pair something with this, brains might be the way to go.
This is both evidence for us discussing ahead of time what the junk food pairing should be and us never discussing ahead of time what the junk food pairing should be.
Well, I mean, nobody would have learned about a Kentucky hot brown.
You know what? Thanks for joining us for this episode solely devoted to the Kentucky hot brown. Next week, we will tell you all about our recipes for the Alabama Hot Pocket, and I hope you will join us. If you would like to join us, you can always find us at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter and Facebook and all that other stuff on iTunes. Please rate and review us, because obviously we deserve your 5 stars. You can also, if you really like the show...
I mean, you really want a Cleveland steamer.
You can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to more of this. More this. Anyway, Cargo, where can people... yes, please let people know where they can find you on the internet.
You can find me on Twitter at Massawyrm, MASSAWYRM. Also on Instagram. And I've got a new podcast that you can check out. It's a 10 to 20 minute podcast. I'm doing it with Dave Chen. It's called Right Along. You can find us at rightalongpodcast.com and I think Right Along Pod on Twitter.
This is where you only talk about David Ayer scripts, right?
We only talk about Cleveland steamers on that. No, it's literally just a different piece of writing advice every week, and we discuss it and how it's applicable. It's specifically for writers or people who want to learn about writing. Nice. But it's not. It is the opposite of what this is.
I feel a little insulted, but we did just talk about Kentucky Hot Brown for a while. Like,
I feel insulted.
Like, I feel like you're just like totally fucking stepped on my head like a zombie coming out of the ground. Like, don't worry, it's not this horse shit. It's something way better.
No, well, for one thing, it's 10 to 20 minutes tops. So it's abbreviated.
We talked about it's Return to the Living point. Dead.
It's got a little class, and there probably will not be a lot of scatological humor.
Look, we had to talk about Ronald Reagan. We had to talk about Family of Cops again. We had to talk about Kentucky Hot Brown, and we had to talk about barbacoa. Like, there was so much.
Five things you will never find on the Right Along podcast.
There you go. So apparently, if you want Cargill's classy podcast, it's Right Along. That's fine. That's fine. I'm gonna go watch Return of the Living Dead 2 because it's party time.